You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hello, Cosmic Pizza Podcast, the show of all sorts that sorts all by serving up a slice of life. What is your order, please? I see. The special it is. We will be there to deliver ASAP. Pizza Podcast special delivery. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. My name is Paul. With me today is
Dan in a swelteringly hot UK
and Sean in a very rainy Canada,
and I'm in the UK as well in a cooler version of the UK. We've had our 2 days of heat wave. Come on, people, 2 days of warm weather. It's not a heat wave.
Well, you broke records.
For 2 days, yes, that's right. I mean, you know, 1976, people, come on. Weeks and weeks and weeks of no rain and dry weather and hot weather and no water. I mean, you know, reservoirs dried up. I mean, 2 days of heat and we're all melting and cars are burning and golf courses are on fire and things.
I'm just sitting here with all fire in the background to everybody listening right now. This isn't like a background for Zoom calls. This is actual fire. But it's fine. It's fine. It's all right.
And the good news is it's a dry heat, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So dry. So dry. Oh, bare to the bone dry.
We're supposed to be having thunderstorms soon, so I think that'll dampen the place down a bit. But anyway, yes, typical British talking about the weather. So let's move on. Let's cheer everybody up. So today's episode, as you've probably gathered by the title, is cartoons of our childhood, part one. And part one is because it's my generation of cartoons, 1960s to 1970s, slightly into the 1980s, just sort of nudging up towards Sean's era. So, it's going to be a long episode, this, I think. I think by the time I've edited in a few sound effects and musics and things, it could be quite a long one. But if not, just in case it's not, it's going to be a short one. Anyway, let's get on with it. So, the obvious shows that I'm going to go for here. All I'm going to do is talk about shows that I have seen. Now, I know there's a lot more out there that I haven't seen. There'll be some that people obviously haven't heard of. Sean's going to be sitting there for a long time listening to me and Dan talking about things that maybe even Dan doesn't know. But we shall see.
Usually the way it goes when I'm listening to you guys and your witty Britishisms. But Uncle Paul, tell me about what it was like when you were a kid.
Well, little Sean, what it was like was everything was in black and white.
Here's the jingly jangly piano. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, everything was in black and white because the license was cheaper. But we had cartoons in the late 60s and early 70s were basically borrowed from America. There were a few British cartoons about. But so most of the early ones that I'm going to quickly whiz through now, you guys will know, because they've been going for years. They're the long runners. Tom and Jerry, the Woody Woodpecker Show, Yogi Bear, Felix the Cat, if you were into that sort of thing. Felix the Cat was knocking around then. This is all sort of like pre-1960. Popeye and Bugs Bunny, they were all there. Then there was some that I saw that not a lot of people clicked onto, so like Quick Draw McGraw, if you remember that one.
Nope.
Oh my goodness, right. Okay, so Quick Draw McGraw, obviously you can tell what it is by the name. It featured three cartoons per episode, with Quick Draw and his sidekick Baba Louie appearing in the first segment, father and son dog duo Augie Doggy and Doggy Daddy in the second, and cat and mouse detectives Snooper and Blabber in the third. There were also bumpers, mini cartoons between the main cartoons featuring Quickdraw and other main characters of the show. He was a blue dog, along the lines of Deputy Dog, that sort of thing, set in the Western setting, and of course he was a Quickdraw. Not the brightest tool in the box, and of course other people would help him out with the sorting out things, but basically that was Quickdraw McGraw. Hanna-Barbera, typical sort of one of their standard things, 1959 that came out. Once we get into 1961, we hit Top Cat.
Top Cat, the most effectual Top Cat, whose intellectual close friends get to call him TC, providing it's with dignity. Top Cat,
everybody knows Top Cat, right?
Yeah.
I don't believe so.
Well, Top Cat and his gang were inspired by the East Side Kids from the 1940s B movie, but also its more immediate roots lay in the Phil Silver show from 1955 to 1959. So you had Sergeant Bilko, was a fast-talking con artist, Private Doberman, who's like, Gosfield. Maurice Gosfield played his part. He also played Benny the Ball in Top Cat, and was basically Benny the Ball was based on his physique as well. He was rather chubby. So Top Cat was basically a gang, of get-rich-quick schemers, and the plot thread would always revolve around the local cop, Officer Dibble, trying to catch them and evict them from the alley and stop them from using the police phone box and all that. The interesting thing was that it was called Top Cat in the US, but when he came over here, it was hastily changed to Boss Cat because Top Cat was the name of a top-selling cat food. And because it was on the BBC, the BBC didn't use advertising, so they couldn't call it Top Cat. So they renamed the titles at the beginning where they had the card saying Top Cat. It would say Boss Cat. But then from then on, the song would say Top Cat. Everything that was involved in internally was called Top Cat. Now and again, they would cut out things if they could, which meant that the cartoon would jump all over the place. And it led to a lot of fights in the schoolyard over, have you seen Top Cat? Top Cat? No, it's Boss Cat. No, it's Top Cat. No, it's Boss Cat. No, it's crazy. So it was only back late in 1989 when they brought it back, they allowed it to be called Top Cat, because by that time Top Cat had gone bust and it didn't exist anymore.
I wonder if that's like the first instance of a Mandela effect, someone remembering a TV show one way but not the other, and it's like, I could have sworn it was called Bus Cat, and then everybody after that just said, oh no, it's always been Top Cat.
Yeah, the younger kids will know it's Top Cat, the older ones remember it as Bus Cat.
Yeah, still getting revivals, still has a movie going, and the kids have seen it today, and it did hold their interest, so something about that format works.
That's right, and I think that's why the Phil Silvers show was really good. It didn't do so well over here, but it was shown over here. Because it was very American, but put a few cats in it, and it's really good. So Snagglepuss, do you remember Snagglepuss?
I do, but only because of Watch with Mother videotapes.
Yes. Yeah. So I remember the original, obviously. So it came out in 1961, but I remember the original as reruns. I'll say that. But I still use his catchphrases now and again. And I didn't realise that I was. And then it was only when I was looking back through this, I thought, oh my goodness, that's where I've got it from. So he's got three catchphrases which he used all the times. Heavens to Murgatroyd would be his main one.
Oh, yes, I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and then if he was going to leave the scene, he'd say, exit, stage left, or right, or whatever. And then he would always end his sentences with the word even. So you'd often hear him say, heavens to Murgatroyd, exit, stage left even. Yeah, even at the word, or even exit, stage left. I use it quite a lot to this day without realising it. But it was from Snagglepuss, a pink mountain lion.
That's right, yes. Part of the Hanna-Barbera family, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, yep.
And he makes appearances in crossovers and various other things that Hanna-Barbera used to do quite a lot.
Yogi Bear, I think he was in, all those things. Yeah.
He was a very sort of well-to-do, you know, thought more of him, more about himself than other people did, that sort of thing. So, yes, moving on to sort of 1963, I'm doing this in sort of a chronological order. 1963, we saw Deputy Dog. Deputy Dog, Deputy Dog. Again, sort of Western-style show. With Musky Muskrat, Ty Coon, Vincent van Gogh, and Pig Newton, as well as Deputy Dog's boss, the sheriff, and his wife, Mrs. Deputy. Then we go to one of the big ones, 1964.
The Magic Roundabout.
This has got the most episodes I have ever seen of any show, let alone a cartoon, mainly because it's French. It then sold itself across the world where, because nobody speaks French, people will put their own words to it. And this is where, Sean, have you heard of Emma Thompson? She's a British actress. Nanny McPhee, played in lots of big shows. Yeah, her father spotted this show whilst in France and thought, hey, that looks rather good. I think we'll bring this over here. So he brought it over to the UK, but he couldn't, you know, obviously in French, it doesn't, you just can't translate French. It was going to take too long. So he basically provided his own script to what he saw on the screen. So he just made it up, in other words. So 441 episodes later, this thing has been sold around the world. Japan, America did it as well. They had their own version, again, all redubbed into American, not necessarily what was going on in the show. It ran from 1965 to 1977, and it used the British version I'm talking about now, used the footage from the French stop-motion animation show, Le Mont... Oh, I can't even say that. The Enchanted Forest, I think it's called, but with completely different scripts and characters. The French series was created with the help of Ivor Wood. Now, Ivor Wood did a lot of animation over in the UK, which we'll talk about later, because he had a big influence on a lot of stuff over here. He just happened to be working over there and was doing the stop motion animation for ORTF, which is the French television station. The BBC originally rejected translating the series because it was charming but difficult to dub into English, but later produced a version of the series using the French footage with new English language scripts, unrelated to the original storylines. This version, written and told by Eric Thompson, was broadcast in 441 5-minute-long episodes. It proved a great success and attained cult status, is saying the least we can say about it, is the cult status. The main character is Dougal, who was a drop-eared variety of the Skye Terrier. Zebedee was a talking jack-in-a-box with magical powers. Brian was a snail. Ermentrude was a cow. Dylan, named after Bob Dylan in the UK version, was a hippie rabbit. Florence was a young girl. And Mr. Rusty was the elderly moustached operator of the roundabout. Other characters included Mr. McHenry, the elderly gardener who rode a tricycle, a talking locomotive, which I can't remember, with a 4-2-2 wheel arrangement and a two-wheel tender. Why on earth would you want to know that? Three other children, and this is where I remember it from. One of them called Paul, and then there's Basil and Rosalie. They appear in a few of the earlier ones, not so much in the later ones. Dougal, Brian, Ermentrude and Dylan all reside in a place called the Magic Garden. The exact distance from where the roundabout and the Magic Garden are in relation to each other was never specifically stated, but given that Zebedee and Florence would always travel there by magical teleportation, it was either considerably far away or simply faster to get there by those means. The show was a distinct visual style. The set is brightly coloured and stylized park containing the eponymous roundabout, a fairground carousel. The programs were created by stop-motion animation, which meant that Dougal was made without legs to make him easier to animate. Zebedee was created from a giant pea, which was available in the animation studio and was repainted. The look of these characters was the responsibility of British animator Ivor Wood, who worked at Danone's studio at the time and who subsequently animated The Herbs, Paddington Bear, and Postman Pat. amongst others. So there you go. It contains such status that it appears in a record, it's a B-side to Funky Moped by Jasper Carrot, and is a rather rude version of him talking about what he would like to have written as the Magic Roundabout. Look it up, it's on YouTube, it's hilarious.
It crossed over into loads of different, using the Magic Roundabout theme tune is often like used as a shorthand over here in the UK in comedy programs that someone's losing their mind. You know, you see someone with a blank expression, you just hear the from the theme tune. Or as I work on this submarine, the Ocelot for the tours, there are four masts on this submarine. There's an attack periscope that you're familiar with from movies and cartoons. There's a green radar dish. There's the radio comms, and then there's the search periscope. And before we had GPS, we used search periscopes to find out where we are. It can also turn 360 degrees, so it got the nickname the Magic Roundabout. Nice. So it even made its way into military jargon as well.
There is a, we have lots of roundabouts over here in the UK. Sean, do you have roundabouts over in Canada?
I know you tend to they've recently started adding them over the last 10 or 15 years, I guess.
Okay, so traffic roundabouts. There's one in Swindon, which is one big roundabout in the middle with five smaller roundabouts around the outside of it. And the middle roundabout is actually a two-way road. It's circular. So you can join this from five different directions using a roundabout to get onto the roundabout, and it's called the Magic Roundabout.
Of course it is.
Again, look it up on the YouTube. It is a horrible... My wife was driving the car and she said, whatever you do, don't take me around the Magic Roundabout. And I said, no, it's okay. We're not going that way. We turned the corner. Hey, presto, there it is right in front of us. I was called quite a few different names when she was trying to navigate that road. Moving on, 1965, Secret Squirrel.
Secret Squirrel.
Secret Squirrel with his sidekick, Morocco Mole. Basically, a secret agent taking orders from his superior, Double Q, of the International Sneaky Service. His designation is Agent 000. Secret Squirrel is assisted by his fez-wearing, bespectacled, the sidekick, Morocco Mole. The pair fights crime and evil enemies, agents using cunning and a variety of spy gadgets, including a machine gun cane, a collection of weapons kept inside Secret's trench coat, which is also bulletproof, and a variety of devices concealed in his purple fedora, which has eye holes cut in it, which he seldom removes. Secret's recurring arch enemy is Yellow Pinky. I have seen Secret Squirrel. Secret Squirrel.
Yeah.
1966, we move into the New Adventures of Superman. Now, I obviously don't need to say any more about that. That was one of the better cartoons, I think. It was, of its time, the animation, really good, but only lasted 68 episodes. Then we move on to the Roadrunner show.
Meep, meep.
Is actually my notification tone for my phone, which you may or may not have heard over the years on this podcast. It keeps going off. We all know about Roadrunner, one of the best painters of a tunnel that has ever existed.
Someday, while a Coyote is going to get him. I always wanted him to get the Emu. I hated Roadrunner. I wanted him to win it. Also, just every time he had that sad, forlorn face and he brings up the signs like, not again, yes. And then falls to his death again. Love it.
It ran for 5 years, well, for 2 years, sorry, then went off the air, then came back on again for about another 2 years, then was pulled off because it was too violent. And yet... Tom and Jerry. Then we move into one of my favorites of all time, which is Camberwick Green. Now, have either of you heard? Sean probably hasn't, but Danny must have heard at least of Camberwick Green.
One of my mum's favorites. She collects all the figures, all the little porcelain figures from Camberwick Green. And, what's the other one? Cuthbert Dillon Grubb.
We'll come back to them.
Yeah, come back to them as well. Yeah, she used to have, I've already mentioned before, Watch With Mother tapes over here in the UK is like a compilation tape of UK cartoons. And they always came with a Hanna-Barbera compilation tape. When you bought one, you bought the two. They were like a double what. So they always had all these Hanna-Barbera cartoons as well. So I knew of, you know, all the different characters from the US. And then you could also get a Campbell-Witt Green compilation tape. So that's where I know them from. Yeah. So again, not from original viewing, but through my parents.
So I have the DVDs of this, and I bought them before I had kids. This is my childhood. Okay, so basically, it's a stop motion puppet show using, I would say, sort of like plasticine figures covered in felt. I suppose is the only way I could really think about it. But the stories were fabulous. They were only short, 15 minutes, I think, and I'll describe them in a bit more, because it's not just one. There's three of these things. Basically, for Campbell-Witt Green, each episode begins with a shot of a musical box, which rotates while playing a tune. It's accompanied by the following narration. Here is a box, a musical box.
Wound up and ready to play. But this box can hide a secret inside. Can you guess what is in it today?
Spoken by Brian Cant. Now, Brian Cant was a children's TV presenter at the time. He did all the voices for quite a lot of these shows. He is my childhood. His voice is so soothing and beautiful to listen to. I think he passed away recently. But when he did, my childhood went straight out the window. It was gone. Each week in the show, it's set in a village, and each week the villagers undergo a domestic crisis, such as a shortage of flour, or a swarm of bees, or a water shortage problem, or rumours of an unwanted electrical substation being built in the village. But all the problems are happily resolved at the end of each episode. The episodes then conclude with the narrator bidding farewell to the puppet character who was seen at the beginning and is shown going back into the musical box. The series is set in the small, picturesque and fictitious village of Camberwick Green, Trumptonshire, which is inhabited by such characters such as Police Constable McGarry, number 452, the iconic Windy Miller, owner of a clanking old but nevertheless efficiently functional windmill, and a firm believer in old-fashioned farming methods and cider. It's hard to explain the show, but basically, each week one of the villagers has a problem and they get fixed at the end of it. And there's always a little bit of a moral in the show as well. Now, I mentioned Trumptonshire there. This was 1966. In 1967, the same people brought out Trumpton. Now, Trumpton is a short distance from the equally fictional village of Campbell-Witt Green, the focus of the first series in the Trumptonshire trilogy. Each episode begins with a shot of the Trumpton Town Hall clock.
Here is the clock, the Trumpton clock, telling the time steadily, sensibly, never too quickly, never too slowly, telling the time for Trumpton.
Right, and off we go. It's Trumpton. So Trumpton is a town. Okay, the townsfolk then appear going about their daily business. The mayor, Mr. Troop, the town clerk, Chippy Minton the carpenter, his apprentice son Nibs, Mrs. Cobbett the florist, Miss Lovelace the milliner, and her trio of Pekingese dogs, Mitzi, Daphne and Lulu, of which the lady right across the road, whose house I can see right from here, has three Pekingese dogs and walks out every now and again. And she says, yes, people do call me Mrs. Lovelace. Mr. Clamp, the greengrocer, Mr. Munnings, the printer, and Mr. Platt, the clockmaker. Although most of the characters and settings are new, the style of the programme follows the pattern established in Campbell-Witt Green, from which a few characters make an appearance in Trumpton, in which the domestic problems are cheerfully resolved by the end of the show, leaving the last minute or so for the Fire Brigade to come to the town band and play the episode out. The Fire Brigade is perhaps Trumpton's most recognised feature, as Dan was about to say. Captain Flack's roll call was recited in all but one episode. Pew, pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert Dibble, Grub. And those were the firemen. Now, you heard me right, pew and pew. There were two pews. They were twins.
Pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert, Dibble, Grub.
And because a lot of people for many years thought it was Hugh Pew or Pew Hugh, but it wasn't. Puppeteer Gordon Murray explained that Pew and Pew are twins, you must understand, not Hugh Pew. In the episode, Cuthbert's morning off, Cuthbert's name is admitted due to his absence, which throws everybody, because everybody knows it's Pew, Pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert, Dibble and Grub, and not Pew, Pew, Barney McGrew, Dibble, Grub. That just doesn't go right. It's horrible when you hear it. You've missed one. Oh. They are continually being called out to attend some emergency or other, in many cases to resolve fairly trivial matters, but to Captain Flack's annoyance, never an actual fire. The main reason for this was the difficulty of animating fire and water and smoke. Although Naked Flame was successfully animated in Episode 8 for the abortive lighting of a bonfire, nonetheless, after Right Men action stations, the fire brigade often absent-mindedly deployed the fire hose and received a rebuke from Captain Flack. No, no, put it away. We're going to get a cat out of a tree. So, again, it's exactly the same as Camboy Cree, but with different characters and set in a town rather than the village. There's one more. We'll come back to that in a minute. Because in the same year that that came out, we have Arabian Nights. Either of you remember Arabian Nights? No?
Maybe once. I know a cartoon from the 90s that sort of tried to do it again. I didn't realize they'd done it before.
Mm. Okay, so this was an insert in the Banana Splits show. They'd do about 10 minutes and then come in with a cartoon. So Prince Turhan, the Prince of Baghdad and rightful heir to the throne of the Sultan, Turhan is a young and handsome teenage boy. Apart from being brave and bold, he is an agile acrobat, an athlete, and master swordsman. Princess Nida, voiced by Shari Lewis, amazingly, daughter of the Caliph of El Rabul, Princess Nida is a beautiful teenage girl who's the cousin of Prince Turhan. That's a bit awkward. She is a master of disguise and an expert of voice mimicry. Farik, the magician, a short, tubby, jolly man. Farik is a skilled practitioner and spellmaster of the mystical arts who lends a magical hand when needed. To cast his spell, Farik would say his magic words, clap his hands above his head, Rosan Kobar! Rasim the Strong, a tall, muscular man with a brief costume and fez. Rasim is the powerhouse of the team with incredible physical strength, endurance and stamina. Zazum, Rasim's faithful little donkey with long ears. Zazum was first used by Turhan, Farik and Rahim to get El Rabul. Zazum is quite an intelligent donkey and he aids his fellow team members. Zazum can spin himself so fast, he like a destructive miniature tornado. He can defeat any enemy or destroy anything coming his way. Does not like his tail to be pulled. It enrages him to the point of a berserk loose cannon that can shatter rocks into pebbles. In addition, Zazum can smell gold very precisely. Bez the Beast, a dark-skinned man with a turban and green clothing. Bez can shapeshift into an animal, bird, or aquatic creature, from a mighty elephant to a tiny mouse. Often he triggers this ability by speaking the phrase, size of an elephant. Not getting it yet? No? No, okay.
Nope. I'm enjoying your performance.
Thank you. Bakar, the Black Sultan, the corrupt conqueror and nemesis of the Arabian Nights. Bakar usurps the throne of Turhan's father and takes control of Baghdad. Clearly wishing to command all of the kingdoms that bow to Baghdad, he sets all of his forces to the goal of capturing Turhan, and later all of the knights to secure his place on the throne. And Vangor is Bakar's enforcer and captain of his guards, often hatches plots to capture the knights. You don't remember this thing? Wow, it's one of my favourite cartoons. It was part of the Banana Splits, like I say, so it was always watched it with them. But the stories were really good. It was very mystical. It was very well set in Persia or Baghdad, around that area. I don't know whether it survives well up till now. I've not seen it recently. Probably like most cartoons, it may not. I think most of them were actually voiced by Americans anyway, so it would be hard to say they could get somebody from Iraq to come over and, you know, play these parts and what have you. So along the same lines, The Three Musketeers. Now, that obviously sounds a bit easier, and it is. It's part of the Banana Splits. It would be the second cartoon that they would play in their show. We all know the Three Musketeers, Athos, Porthos, Aramis, and D'Artagnan. They fight the crowned heads of France, King Louis the what is it, 14th, and Queen Anne, sometimes assisted by the Queen's handmaiden, Lady Constance, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, lots of sword fighting and stuff like that. Of course, it's always the all for one and one for all slogan in there. Next one, you'll definitely know. It's the Wacky Races. Can we all name the Wacky Races, the actual...
No, I don't believe we can.
Okay. If I give you the name, could you name the car? If I give you the car, could you name the people? Or should I just tell you what they are? So
was it Captain Caveman was one of them?
No, close. The Slag Brothers, Rock and Gravel. Caveman themed themed race car. The car was the Bolt.
First is the Turbo Terrific, driven by Peter Perfect. Next, Rufus Roughcut and Sawtooth in the Buzz Wagon. Maneuvering for position is the Army Surplus Special. Right behind is the Ant Hill Mob in their bulletproof bomb. And there's ingenious inventor, Pat Pending, in his converter car. Oh, and here's the lovely Penelope Pitstop, the glamour gal of the gas pedal. Next, we have the Bouldermobile with the Slag Brothers, Rock and Gravel. Lurching along is the Creepy Coupe with the Gruesome Twosome. And right on their tail is the Red Mac. And there's the Arkansas Chugabug with Luke and Blubber Bear. Sneaking along last is that mean machine with those double-dealing do-batters, Dick Dastardly and his sidekick, Muttley. And even now, they're up to some dirty trick, and they're off!
And Dastardly is the only racer who not only never wins, but never finishes in the top three in any race. Now, I've done my homework on this. I have watched every episode. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I've got it correct, but I've got it wrong. So if you were to apply championship points to each of these race finishes, you can only really do the top three, because in some episodes you don't see any more than the top three. They show the top three, they don't show the rest, or they all come over to one or whatever. Well, it's dust and you can't see them. So what I did is I applied, at that time in the 1960s, the championship points for a Formula One race were 9, 6, 4, 3, 2, 1. So I just went 9, 6, 4, applied those points to the top three. And the winners are Rock and Gravel, the Slag Brothers in the Bouldermobile. And that's where I'm going to have to stop, because unfortunately, I was going to say that Penelope Pitstop won more races than anybody else. Everybody won about three, some won four, and Penelope Pitstop was five. However, I've been onto the Wikipedia site, and they show all of the finishing positions for everybody. And I've got a couple of gaps in my thing. They've done it slightly differently, so I'm going to have to relook at it. Whereas I thought it was one race, it's actually two. There are two episodes for the same named race, and it's confused me slightly. So I'm going to have to go back and have a look at it. But definitely, even in their rankings, the Boulder Brothers came first. So there you go.
I can't say I've ever heard of that show.
Oh, my goodness.
But you know what I have heard of? I've heard of this podcast that we're going to play a promo for right here on the ESO Network.
Helm, report.
Sir, there's Klingons on the starboard bow.
Starboard bow?
Starboard bow!
What are they doing there?
They seem to be waiting for the new episode of Earth Station Trek.
Science, what do we know about this Earth Station Trek?
It's a podcast that tracks through the history of Star Trek, from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between.
Navigation, how would one find such a podcast?
By setting coordinates for earthstationtrek.com or by doing a sensor sweep of Spotify, iTunes, or any other quadrant where fine podcasts are available.
Captain, what are we going to do about the Klingons?
We come in peace, Commander. Weapon station, shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill?
Shoot to kill.
The whole way through, as you were describing the Wacky Races, I was like, how is Sean going to turn this around? Like, how is he actually going to change the words to like fit in a promo? I was wondering that at the same time I was processing, like, who's actually won? And what are the races? Yeah, brilliant.
Well, I'm sure. Well, I'm sure this. Yeah. I'm sure the Earth Station Trek podcast would have won the Wacky Races had they had entered. There you go.
Of course.
I'm surprised you've not heard of that. It's an American show. It's got Dick Dastardly and Muttley in it.
Those two characters sound familiar, but yeah. Nothing else does.
Well, they come back again later on in our run through of all these shows. Don't worry, we're only a third of the way through. moving on to The Herbs. Now, The Herbs, Sean won't know this one because this was a British show. The Herbs consisted of a fantasy mix of human and animal characters inhabiting the magical walled garden of a country estate. At the beginning of each episode, the narrator spoke the magic word herbidaceous, which caused the garden gate to open. Each character was the personification of a herb. As each character appeared in the show, they were introduced by a signature song, which varied slightly from one episode to the next. As with the Magic Roundabout, as we spoke about before, the sophisticated writing style and narrative delivery of the herbs meant that the appeal was somewhat broader than was originally intended, and much of Parsley's droll humour undoubtedly went over the heads of the age group that it was meant as its main target. Consequently, it still remains a following amongst those who watched it when it was first broadcast. Now, that's what I was going to say about a lot of these shows. They were written with adults in mind as well. They weren't talking down to the children like in your Night Garden does or your Teletubbies does now. It was written by adults as though it was talking to young adults. And that's why they are so brilliant and so educational and so well still received now that people still love them to this day, because the crap they're coming out with these days is ridiculous. Anyway, Parsley the Lion, they're a shy but friendly main character, always sat on the path in front of the herb garden to welcome the viewers.
I'm a very friendly lion called Parsley, with a tail for doing jobs of every kind. But I mustn't treat it roughly or too harshly, for it's such a useful thing to have behind.
Dill the dog, a hyperactive dog who was always getting into scrapes. So Dill the dog's song, he would be running around in a circle. He says, I'm Dill the dog. I'm a dog called Dill. My tail I try to get, but I've never caught it yet. I can remember that from 50 years ago, yet I can't remember when I put my pen down 10 seconds ago.
This makes me wish we had a video podcast so everybody could just see what you're doing.
Yeah. Do you know what I found? I have found that every podcast we have recorded has also been recorded in video.
Well, we need a YouTube channel then.
Unfortunately, you would see all the bits that I cut out from the normal show. And you'd realize just how amateur this thing is.
That's perfect for our Patreon.
This is true. Yeah,
if we had a Patreon.
That's very true.
It's true. Well, maybe we could do that with this one. Okay, so we have Dill the Dog.
I'm Dill the Dog. I'm a dog called Dill. Though my tail I'd love to get, I have never caught it yet.
Sage the Owl, a plump, bad tempered owl.
And a rather fat, feathery owl called Sage. I'm using my wing to turn over the page. Over the wings, for the wings of a dove. Printed in England by Newton and Love.
Sir Basil, bumbling aristocrat with an enormous red nose.
I am Sir Basil, the king of the herbs, and I'm very often in trouble. I'm not very good at sorting things out, and often I get in a muddle.
Lady Rosemary, Sir Basil's prim and proper wife.
My name is Lady Rosemary. You will find you can't fool me. I have eyes both sharp and quick to help me see through every trick.
Constable Knapweed, a policeman who was constantly writing herbs' names in nonsensical crimes in his notebook.
I am Constable Knapweed, and I keep law and order. I watch to see that all is well along the garden border.
Bayleaf the Gardener.
I'm Bayleaf, I'm the gardener. I work from early dawn. You'll find me sweeping up the leaves and tidying the lawn.
Aunt Mint, an old auntie-like woman who was nearly always seen sitting in a rocking chair and knitting.
My name is Auntie Mint. I'm always very busy. I often have so much to knit, it makes me feel quite dizzy.
Mr. Onion, father and schoolmaster of the Chives. Mrs. Onion, the wife of Mr. Onion and mother of the Chives. The Chives, the Onion's 10 children.
Because there are so many Chives all looking like each other, it makes it even hard to tell a sister from a brother.
Tarragon the Dragon, and Pashani Bedi, an Indian snake charmer, which definitely would not go down too well these days. All stop motion animation, and it was one of the first cartoons I probably ever saw. I've got that on DVD as well. Then we move on to Dastardly and Muttley and their flying machines.
Muttley, you snickering, floppy-eared hound. When courage is needed, you're never around. Those medals you wear on your moth-eaten chest should be there for bungling at which you are best. So, stop the pigeon, 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 ow! Damn him, jam him, tan him, grab him, stop that pigeon, now!
Now, this is maybe one thing you remember. It's also known as Catch the Pigeon, which is... that's what people remember it as, but it's actually Dastardly and Muttley and their flying machines. Dick Dastardly and Muttley, the villains from the Wacky Races, are now flying aces in World War I style aeroplanes and members of Vulture Squadron on a mission to stop a messenger pigeon named Yankee Doodle Pigeon from delivering top secret messages to an opposing army. The other members of the squadron are Clunk, an inventor who speaks an unintelligible language, punctuated by howls, clicks, whistles, and growls, accompanied by bizarre facial contortions. Wait for it, I'm about to do it. And Zilly, a very timid pilot, whose main role is to translate for Clunk. So Clunk, basically he had a collar right up to his neck, and he had a really fat face, and Dick Dastardly would say, "Clunk, what happened to the pigeon?" Clunk would say, "Well, Chief, he acting the pigeon, Chief." Dick Dastardly go, look at Zilly and say, "What did he say?" "Oh me, oh my, he said he's going to acting the pigeon, Chief."
"All right, Clunk, what's this silly looking thing you've got here?"
"It's his latest invention, Petey. He calls it the Sneeze-O-Missile missile. We put a little pepper at the pigeon, and when he ka-choo, we pow, the missile we in on him, and then bang, ka-boom, no more pigeon."
Yes, it was hilarious.
It was.
You had to be there. Another spin-off of the Wacky Races were the Perils of Penelope Pitstop. Each episode, Penelope's guardian, Sylvester Sneakley, attempts to claim Penelope's inheritance for himself by attacking her in the disguise of his sinister alter ego, the Hooded Claw. Aided by his twin henchmen, the Bully Brothers, who always spoke in unison, even though the anthill mob often came to Penelope's rescue, she herself often needs to save the mob from the unintended effects of their attempts to rescue her. But just as quickly as Penelope is delivered from one quandary, she almost immediately finds herself ensnared in another one. Despite their overall bumbling, however, the anthill mob always managed to rescue Penelope and foil the Hooded Claw's plans in the end. Sort of 1920s, 1930s, silent film style of bad guys, you know, you tie it to the train tracks and all that type of thing. Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? We've all seen this one. We all know Scooby-Doo. These episodes we're talking about really here are 1969, 1970, and 1970 to 73 in the UK. But can you name the four people in Scooby-Doo?
Fred, Daphne, Velma, and Shaggy.
And Scooby-Doo, yes, of course, it should be five. But anyway, yeah, but full names, surnames as well.
No.
Oh, come on. I didn't even know they had surnames until I looked this up. Fred Jones, Daphne Blake, Velma Dinkley, and Shaggy Rogers.
Okay.
There you go. I did not know their names. Maybe it was later on in the films or something, the film or not. I don't know. But
There is a new one where it's sort of a bit more like a continuous series. So it's actually completely serialized, and it's set as if they were... They just haven't made the mystery machine yet. They haven't quite gone out to become who they will be eventually. And they're still dealing with their family. So you meet their families and their parents and the people who are forcing them down this route of mystery investigation. I think they bring up the Serlings in that. But again, my kids watch all the different versions. There's been about four different reboots, as far as I can remember, in the 12 years that I've had children. It just keeps coming back. And I don't know how you take the same premise and it's exactly the same thing every single time.
That's right.
And it still works. And I don't know how.
It's bizarre that this is the one that carried on, because there's been so many versions of this. You know, you got Scooby-Doo, and then you got Captain Caveman, you Josie and the Pussycats. Everything's the same as Scooby-Doo, and yet Scooby-Doo keeps going. No matter how many people copy it, this one remains. But it's just the dog. I mean, until they got to Scrappy-Doo, and then that was just a waste of time.
Scrappy-Dappy-Doo.
So... I know. I love, there's a meme that goes around. I love it. I've got it saved on my phone, where Fred has unmasked the villain, and it's Fred. I just love that. Okay, moving on to It's the Wolf. No, don't know this one. Okay, it's going to be a bit harder to complain. Obviously, there's a wolf. There's a lamb. The wolf chases the lamb. Hilarity ensues. But Paul Lind did the voice of the wolf. And Paul Lind is a fantastic voice for bad guys and sneaky people and all that. You'll recognize his voice instantly. You'll hear it. And he will blend you listening to this when I get to put the sound effects in.
Leave them alone and they'll come home. Oh, at last.
Oh, at last what?
At last I found my little lost sheep. I'm Bo Peep, you know.
This seems like a job for Bristlehound.
Come along. You'll be late for Dem-Den.
Just a minute. I have a little something to do first. Me. yeah, that's it. It's the Wolf! It's the Wolf. That's who it is, the Wolf. It's the Wolf!
The Pink Panther Show. One of my favorite. Both me and my sister loved this thing. I loved the... The Pink Panther was great anyway. He only ever speaks once, as far as I can recollect. Obviously, a spin-off of the actual opening credits to the films. 30-minute show, which is quite ambitious, but also has animated inserts with the Inspector sandwiched into it, with the usual sort of Inspector Clouseau bumbling around. Then we come to the third in the series of Campbell Green Trumpton, and the third one is Chiggley. As in Campbell Green and Trumpton, the action centres on a small community, the village of Chiggley, near Campbell Green in Trumptonshire. Chiggley is a more of an industrial area than Campbell Green. Winkstead Hall, a stately home, is central to the life in Chiggley. The aristocratic owner, Lord Belborough, and his butler, Brackett, also operate a heritage railway. They are called on to transport or collect goods in every episode, much to Lord Belborough's delight, as he loves driving the engine, named Bessie. Another character frequently delighted by these excursions is Winnie Farthing, this is where it gets weird, whom Lord Belborough and Brackett nearly always invite to join them for a train ride. The notable song unique to Chiggley, Time Flies By When I'm a Driver of a Train, and I ride on the footplate there and back again, under bridges, over bridges to my destination.
Popping through the countryside, there's so much to be seen. Passengers waving as we steam through a station. Soak up, I'm on, for the signal is at green. Time flies by when I'm the driver of a train, and I ride on the footplate there and back again. In the cutting through the tunnel, rushing, clanking on the track.
was always sung during these sequences. Winkstead Hall and its grounds are regularly open to the public, who have access to the picture gallery and the tea gardens, both regularly seen. Other parts of the hall and its estate, which are also featured in the programme, include the library, the hall, the kitchen garden and greenhouses, the engine shed, home of Bessie, and the pump room, home of Binny, Lord Belborough's stationary steam beam engine. Chiggley features many guest appearances by characters from previous two series. This was at least partly for economic reasons, as it allowed the reuse of theme songs and puppets, thus saving money on recording and manufacture. Lord Belborough invites everybody to the grounds of Winkstead Hall after the daily 6 o'clock whistle, which marks the end of the day's work. What a bugger. Just when you think you've finished work, you've got to go and have a dance in the boss's tea garden. It marks the end of the day's work at the local biscuit factory. When he plays his vintage Dutch organ while the workers dance, the scene forms the conclusion of each episode. So, Lord Belborough, he's got a big stately home, and when somebody knocks at the front door, Brackett, the butler, has to go and answer the door. It takes him at least 1 minute to walk down this corridor to get to the thing, while his music is playing for his character.
With bats in the belfry and beetle in the beams, the stately home of England is not all that it seems. A constant battle must be fought to fend off all decay. The only way to meet the cost is hold an open day.
Every time we go round to my in-laws, we press the doorbell and I start playing his theme tune music while we wait for the in-laws to get to the door, while they climb the stairs up to the door. We can see their shadows through the glass window. Yes, here they come. They're coming. They're nearly there. They're at the door. Hey, we're in. And I'm playing that music on my phone every time. The wife goes mad. So there you go. The three. Now, I thought that all of that would have been made up places and things, which they are. They're fictional places. They're based on three villages in Sussex, and I'm going to go down there and have a look at them next year. Also, while I go and have a look at something else, which I'll come back to in a bit later. Then we come to one that I know Dan's heard of, because we mentioned this last week in last week's episode, Mary, Mungo and Midge.
A town is full of buildings, some tall, some short, some wide, and some narrow. The buildings are flats and houses and factories and shops. They're built in streets.
Now, this show featured the adventures of a girl called Mary, a dog, Mungo, and her pet mouse, Midge, who lived with Mary's parents in a tower block in a busy town, so an apartment block. BBC newsreader Richard Baker narrated the episodes with John Ryan's daughter, Isabel, playing Mary.
The streets have cars and buses and lorries driving along them. The cars and buses and the streets are full of people. In fact, there are a lot of people in a town. Do you live in a town?
The show was one of the first children's shows in the UK to reflect urban living. The programme showed Mary having her adventures in a busy town, as opposed to in a wood, forest, or villages, as we've discussed. In each episode, the three of them would descend in the lift from their flat in the tower block. After their adventures, they would return home. Midge would press the button for the lift back to the correct floor by standing on Mungo's nose.
Boobity, 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 boob. Yeah, I still play that in my head every time I see a lift yeah. going up.
Great. It was an animated cartoon, so it was all two-dimensional. It was great. And like they say, the first time you see somebody living in an apartment block and not in a middle-class BBC version of a little village somewhere. Mm. Stay with us, Sean. I know you're nodding off there. Then we have the Moomins. Moomins it's a Finland cartoon, Finnish cartoon, a family of white, round fairy tale characters with large snouts that make them resemble a hippopotamus. However, despite the resemblance, the Moomin family are trolls. They live in the house called the Moomin Valley, though in the past, their temporary residence have included a lighthouse and a theatre. And they have many adventures along with their various friends.
Still gives me nightmares today.
There you go. Now I know what to do.
Something about it. So creepy. Such a creepy design. The animation, the look of them, the fact you can't see their mouths. It just freaks me out. They are faceless hippopotami with just two eyes. And you don't know if they're talking because nothing moves on them. They just drift into the shot and then they drift back out again. And then when the human character comes in and she's got this pointy nose with just the two eyes and she just sort of glides into shot. just, it's freaky. I don't know why kids like it. And they tried to bring it back with a movie recently. Yeah. Still can't figure out why.
Yeah. Yeah. The Moomins are, they are sold all over the world. Everyone has a version of the Moomins. They're like a shmoo in America. The shmoo is a similar thing. And then we move on to the Harlem Globetrotters, which obviously the basketball team, which, you know, I loved watching the live action version of the Harlem Globetrotters, let alone the cartoons. But it's just funny that the description for it says, to ensure the Globetrotters defeat the villains, to ensure that the Globetrotters defeat, the villains rig the contest, which would, it would always be a basketball game at the end of the show. However, before the second half of the contest, the team always finds a way to even the odds, become all but invincible and win the game. Well, of course they do that. The Harlem Globetrotters, what do you expect?
But they had their own cartoon. They just didn't show up in other people's? Because I remember them being on Scooby-Doo and other things, but I didn't know they had their own.
Yeah, they might well have done. Again, Hanna-Barbera, so of course they're going to turn up. Anything, you know, I mean, you see what the Flintstones could do when what they did with all of their things. They're aliens and things coming from the future and all sorts of stuff.
Hello, dum-dum.
Sorry. So Josie and the Pussycats animated version of Josie was an amalgam of plot devices, villain types, settings, moods, and tones from other Hanna-Barbera shows, such as Scooby-Doo, Where Are You?, Johnny Quest, Space Ghost, and Shazam. Each episode found the Pussycats and crew en route to perform a gig or record a song in some exotic location where somehow, often due to something Alexandra did, they became mixed up in an adventure. The antagonist was always a diabolical mad scientist, spy, criminal who wanted to take over the world using some high-tech device. The Pussycats usually found themselves in possession of plans for an invention, an item of interest to the villains, a secret spy message, etc. And the villains chased them to retrieve it. Eventually, the Pussycats would ruin the villains' plans, resulting in a final chase sequence set to a Pussycat song. With the villain captured, the Pussycats would return to their gig or recording sessions. The final gag was always the one of Alexandra's failed attempts to interfere with the Pussycats' performance or steal Alan away from Josie. Now, that's where I find it a bit interesting, because for many, many years, I thought the name of the Scooby-Doo character of Fred was called Alan. I'm wondering whether he looked anything like him.
Is it the same animation style?
Yeah, oh, he looks similar. Yellow hair, looks a bit younger. So I've obviously got him confused at some point, and for many, many years was calling Fred Allen. And I did get some weird looks, and people say, who? I'm like, oh, who's this bloody Allen? It was only when I read that, when I was doing my research, I thought, oh, crap, that's where he's from.
See, you need to adjust that meme now, so it's Fred pulling the mask off another Fred. But then it reveals Alan.
And it's Alan. Ah.
The whole time.
And then underneath I could write, and I would have had it right if it wasn't for that pesky kid. 1970 to 1971, the Tomfoolery Show. I don't expect either of you to remember this. This was the most bizarre work I have ever seen in my life. The Tomfoolery Show is a 1970 to 1971 American animated comedy television series based on the works of Edward Lear, which aired on NBC. The animation was done at the Hallis and Batchelor Studios in London and Stroud. Though the works of other writers were also used, notably Lewis Carroll and Ogden Nash, Lear's works were the main source. The characters were the Yongi Bongi Bo and the Umbrageous Umbrella Maker were all Lear creations. Other characters, including the enthusiastic elephant, the fastidious fish, the scroobious snake. Some original material was also written based on characters created by Lear, although much of the material was a straight recital of poems and limericks, or songs using Lear's poems set to music. A recurring joke... This will make you laugh. A recurring joke had a delivery boy running around trying to deliver a large plant and shouting, "Plant for Mr. Discobulus." No, I don't get it either. The show also included characters from some of Gellert Burgess's work, including the Purple Crow and the Groups. I'm going to stop there because I watched some of the first episode on YouTube the other day. Why? It's just bonkers. It's got a snake with a straw hat, and the eyes are in the hat, and he takes his hat off to, you know, bow to somebody, and the eyes are still in the hat. It's so weird. lasted less. Well, I don't know how long it lasted. It lasted 1 year, but I don't know how many episodes there were because I can't find that out. But it was panned by everybody. But I can remember watching it and thinking, "This is brilliant." I don't know why. It is so bizarre. I've seen, you think the Banana Splits is bad. You know, they're just bonkers. You know, this is just another level. Anyway, moving on. The Adventures of Parsley. Well, we've done the Herbs. This is a spin-off from the Herbs. Just Parsley and Dill doing their stuff. Crystal Tips and Alistair. The title characters are a girl and her dog who are joined by their friends Birdie and Butterfly. You can guess what they are. There are 55-minute episodes and a 20-minute Christmas special, all shown between 1972 and 1974. Yeah, girl, dog, have adventures. Then we get to another one, Mr. Ben. Now, Mr. Ben is another classic. Mr. Ben is a man, and they were talking about making a film out of this, and there was talk of John Hannah doing it, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Mr. Ben, it wouldn't work because it would be too good. Mr. Ben was a man wearing a black suit and a bowler hat. He leaves his hat at, take note of this, 52 Festive Road in London, and visits a fancy dress costume shop where he's invited in by the mustachioed fez-wearing shopkeeper to try on a particular outfit. He leaves the shop through a magic door at the back of the changing room and enters a world appropriate to his costume, where he has an adventure, which usually contains a moral. But before the shopkeeper reappears to lead him back to the changing room, the story comes to an end, and Mr. Ben returns to his normal life, but he is left with a small souvenir of his magical adventure. Additional scenes before and after his adventure usually have some connection to it, such as the games the children are playing in the streets as he passes. Brilliant show. It is made for something, but I don't know what. To go into a fancy dress costume shop, to dress up as a knight, to open a magical door and suddenly there's a dragon and a horse. You have to get rid of the dragon. And of course, you don't slay the dragon. It's a children's cartoon. So you make friends with the dragon. You get him to become a barbecue or something, you know, and we can help the people, you know, have some food or whatever. It's such a brilliant concept.
That would make an excellent live-action show.
I think it would, but at the same time, it would be too good because this is, again, another animated cardboard cutout style, two-dimensional show and had its own nice little feel to it. I don't know whether it would translate very well to a modern-day CGI, you know, fully pumped-up dragon with a guy in a bowler hat. I don't know whether that would work. But it needs something. It needs to come back in its old-fashioned way. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you what I'm going to do in a minute when we come back from this break.
Suddenly, as if by magic, the shopkeeper appeared.
So I did a bit of digging because it mentions in the Wikipedia page that the David McKee, who actually wrote Mr. Ben, based it on his own, you know, the house he was in. He thought, oh, this would be great. I wonder if, you know, living next door to this guy would be fantastic. So 52 Festive Road is not a real place, but 52 Festing Road is in Putney. And lo and behold, 54 is next door. And at the beginning of the road, there's a paving slab that says, I could bring it up and I've forgotten to, this road is the home of David McKee, creator of Mr. Ben. When I go to look for Chiggley, Trumpton and Campbell Green, I will go down to Putney and I will have a look at this this paving stone, take a picture. And take a picture of the actual... it's a row of terraced houses, basically. So Mr. Penn would come out of the house and walk down the road. There'd be kids playing in the, you know, doing hopscotch or skipping or something like that in the road. So I shall have to do that. Right. I need to speed up here because there's a lot to get through. I mentioned the Hair Bear Bunch. Help, it's the Hair Bear Bunch. 16 episodes of that. Finger Bobs. Finger Bobs was a... Now, this was interesting because I didn't know this until I read this. Finger Bobs is a guy sat in front of a desk and he uses his hands. And on his hands, he will put cardboard cutouts of a mouse or a tortoise or things like that. Does this ring a bell with you at all, Sean?
Not even a little bit.
Maybe it didn't go over there then, because it was presented by mime artist Yoffy, who's played by Rick Jones, who's a Canadian mime artist.
Huh. Never heard of him either.
Ah, there you go. Bald hair and a beard. Hang on a minute. I'm looking at a bald-headed man with a beard right now.
You are.
There would be 10-minute episodes, each centered on a paper finger puppet, involving collecting various items such as pebbles or feathers. There was finger mouse, there was a scampi, there was a seagull, tortoise, various things, and they all had their own little songs as they came into the show. So there seems to be quite a good theme there. A lot of music involved in kids' programs in the early days. Another American one was Wait Till Your Father Gets Home. Don't know whether you saw that one.
Nope, never heard of it.
Okay, it's based on an American TV show, an adult TV show, All in the Family.
Okay.
And it is often referred to as the great-grandfather of adult animated sitcoms, because this basically was an animated adult show, but it wasn't offensive, so kids, you know, would watch it as well. But yeah, it was very much, you know, family of however many people, four or five or whatever, and hilarity ensues. We then have Inch High, Private Eye. You see that one? Nope.
Never heard of it.
Character was modelled after Maxwell Smart, the main character in the 1965 to 1970 comedy Get Smart. And the performance of the character is an imitation of the Don Adams character. The Inch High is a private eye, is a miniature detective, literally 1 inch high, who's attained his diminutive stature by way of a secret shrinking potion. Inch often enlists the help of his niece, Laurie, also her muscle-bound friend, Gator, and their dog, Braveheart, to help solve mysteries. And the usual sort of thing. He works for the Pinkerton Detective Agency, obviously, lampoon of Pinkerton Detective Agency. None of these characters are teenagers, which is unusual for a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. And he goes around solving puzzles, but of course, half the time he doesn't, it's somebody else that does it for him. Hong Kong Phooey.
Heard of it.
Yeah. Hong Kong Phooey was a... he was voiced by Scatman Crothers. So you can imagine the voice that is very sort of southern sort of drawl. He's a clumsy... Hong Kong Phooey is the clumsy secret identity of Penrod Penry Pooch, working at a police station as a mild-mannered janitor under the glare of Sergeant Flint, named the Sarge. Penry disguises himself as Hong Kong Phooey by jumping into a filing cabinet. In doing so, he always gets stuck and is unstucked by his striped pet cat named Spot. Once disguised, gets equipped with the Phooey Mobile, a vehicle that transforms itself into a boat, a plane, or a telephone booth, depending on the circumstances. In fighting crime, he relies on his copy of the Hong Kong Book of Kung Fu, a correspondence course in martial arts instruction handbook. However, his successes are only either by thanks to Spot, who provides the solution to the challenges, or the direct result of a comically unintended side effect of his efforts. Hong Kong Phooey, number one super guy. So we go backwards. We get to the Wombles.
Ground, overground, wombling free. the Wombles of Wimbledon, common are we, making good use of the things that we find, things that the everyday folks leave behind.
Another iconic British stop motion series made in 1973 to 1975. The Wombles are creatures that live underground, collecting and recycling human rubbish. The characters are all voiced by Bernard Cribbins. Bernard Cribbins is a character who's been in Doctor Who, in case you might have seen him.
He's been several different characters. He was a father of a companion, and then he was in a Doctor Who movie as well when he was younger. But you mentioned earlier how Kant was your voice of your childhood. Cribbins is one of mine. He's been voicing so much ever since. I mean, it's still going today as well. He's still doing BBC, CBeebies stories even today. Jack and Rory.
My goodness, he was born in 1928, for goodness sake. 93 years old. Holy cow. Good man. Well done. Then we moved on to what has been termed the Britain's favourite children's television programme of all time. Any ideas? Bearing in mind, this is 1974, just after the Wombles.
What beats the Wombles? The Wombles have kept coming back. I mean, because they're wombling free all the time. No idea.
Bagpuss.
Bagpuss.
The title, this is beautiful. I texted you yesterday saying that this, I was tearing up and couldn't see through the tears. It was after I read this. So the title character is a saggy old cloth cat, baggy and a bit loose at the seams. Although only 13 episodes were produced and broadcast, the programme remains fondly remembered and was frequently repeated in the UK until 1986. In 1999, Bagpuss topped a poll for the UK's favourite television programme. Each programme begins with the same way, through a series of sepia photographs. The viewer is told of a little girl named Emily who owned a shop.
Once upon a time, not so long ago, there was a little girl, and her name was Emily. And she had a shop.
Emily finds lost and broken things and displays them in the window.
There it is. It was rather an unusual shop because it didn't sell anything. You see, everything in that shop window was a thing that somebody had once lost, and Emily had found, and brought home to Bagpuss.
That in itself is a brilliant idea, a brilliant concept. Lost and found, effectively. Find things, put them in a shop, and if people are walking by, they get to see it. She would leave the object in front of her favourite stuffed toy.
Emily's cat, Bagpuss. The most important. The most beautiful. The most magical, saggy old cloth cat in the whole wide world. Well now, one day Emily found a thing. And she brought it back to the shop and put it down in front of Bagpuss, who was in the shop window, fast asleep as usual.
Emily then recites a verse.
Bagpuss, dear Bagpuss, old fat furry catpuss, wake up and look at this thing that I bring. Wake up, be bright, be golden and light. Bagpuss, oh hear what I sing. And Bagpuss was wide awake.
The programme shifts from sepia to colour stop-motion film, and various toys in the shop come to life.
And when Bagpuss wakes up, all his friends wake up too. The mice on the mouse organ woke up and stretched. Madeleine the rag doll. Gabriel the toad.
Oh, look! Look! Oh,
yeah. And last of all, Professor Yaffle, who is a very distinguished old woodpecker. He climbed down off his bookend and went to see what it was that Emily had brought.
Mm-hmm. There are six mice carved on the side of a mouse organ, a small mechanical pipe organ that plays rolls of music. They wake up and scurry around singing in high-pitched voices. There is a rag doll made of scraps called Madeline, who sits in a wicker chair, Gabriel, the toad, and the wooden woodpecker bookend became the dryly academic Professor Yaffle. After being introduced by the narrator, the toys discuss what the new object is. One of them tells a story related to the object, sometimes shown in an animated thought bubble over Bagpuss's head, often with a song, accompanied by Gabriel on the banjo, which often sounded a lot more like a guitar, and then the mice singing in their high-pitched squeaky harmony to the tune of Summer is Icumen as they worked mending the broken object.
We will wash it, we will wash it, bring the bucket and mop, mop, mop. We will dust it, we will brush it, we will polish it, top, top, top.
We will wash it, we will splash it, bring the bucket and mop, mop, mop.
We will dust it, we will brush it, we will polish it, top, top, top.
We will polish it, top, top, top.
There is much banter between the characters, with the pompous Yaffle constantly finding fault with the playful mice. His complaint, "Those mice are never serious," becomes his main catchphrase. However, peace is always restored by the end of the episode, usually thanks to the timely intervention of Bagpuss, Gabriel, or Madeline. The newly mended object is then placed in the shop window so that whoever had lost it would see it as they went past and would come in to collect it. Then Bagpuss starts yawning again. As he falls asleep, the narrator would speak as the colour faded into sepia and they all freeze in time again. Or as the narrator states, they go to sleep too.
Bagpuss gave a big yawn and settled down to sleep. And of course, when Bagpuss goes to sleep, all his friends go to sleep too. The mice were ornaments on the mouse organ. Gabriel and Madeleine were just dolls, and Professor Yaffle was a carved wooden bookend in the shape of a woodpecker. Even Bagpuss himself, once he was asleep, was just an old, saggy cloth cat, baggy and a bit loose at the seams. But Emily loved him.
And that's why it's the best show, best kids show ever made. It is brilliant in concept, fantastic in its presentation, and just so sweet. Dan is going in and out and in and out all the time.
He certainly is. Yeah. He's having trouble with his internet for sure.
This internet is very, very screwy right now. I think there's a storm outside, so I think that might be what's affecting it. But who knows right now? Maybe Bagpuss is getting into the system. I just don't know. There's naughty mice.
It's either that or it's rhubarb and custard.
Oh, no, 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 yeah.
The theme of that is of a friendly rivalry between Rhubarb, a green dog with an overactive imagination, and Custard, the mischievous, iconic pink cat from the next door. The narration of the series was provided by the actor Richard Briers. The series was a success, greatly loved by children and adults alike, winning numerous awards. The series was also known for its eccentric use of quirky wordplay and sight gags, which is probably why I liked it. Another one that Dan will definitely know, Captain Pugwash.
Yeah,
being a bit of a pirate yourself, Dan, you know.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, many a time I watched an episode with Master Bates and everything. And yeah, there's lots of jokes in the UK, really, that springs from Pugwash, even though Pugwash didn't really last very long, as far as I remember.
Yes, two of those. Let me dispel those myths straight away. It's not, it is not masturbates, it is mastermate. And there was another one that so somebody supposedly said that semen stains was in there. Nice. Now I can categorically deny this because the creator, John Ryan, I think it was, he sued the Sun newspaper, which is our worst tabloid newspaper of all, £10,000 because they couldn't prove that it was in there, even though they had said it was. So they were basing it on what people were saying and not what actually was happening. There is no semen stain to that. It does. There are a couple of words in there that sounds like it could be, but it is not. So there you go. It's a fictional pirate series based on books by John Ryan. The characters' adventures were adapted into a TV series using cardboard cutouts filmed in live action. The first series was performed and broadcast live in 1957, but then a colour series was later shown in 1974 to 1975. Captain Pugwash.
The hearties.
Another French cartoon, Barber Popper. It's along the lines of the sort of Moomins, same sort of thing, shape-shifting French series.
Nightmare Fuel. Blobs, yeah, right? Got it.
Colourful blobs.
Yeah. Ivor the Engine. It was narrated by Oliver Postgate, another voice from my childhood. The series was originally made for black and white television by Small Films for Association Rediffusion in 1958, but was later revived in 1975, which I thought it was a lot earlier than this, when new episodes in colour were produced for the BBC. The colour series consisted of 45-minute films. These would often each form part of a longer story. The series was written, animated and narrated by Oliver Postgate, and Peter Furman provided the artwork. The sound effects were endearingly low-tech, with sound of Ivor's puffing made by Oliver Postgate himself. Boop, boop. The music was composed by Vernon Elliott and predominantly featured as a solo bassoon to reflect the three notes of Ivor's whistle.
Ivor the Engine. There he is, trundling along the loop line above the quarry. And there's Jones the Steam, his driver, without a care in the world.
The Great Grape Ape Show. Grape Ape, over 40 feet high. Do, 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 do. Grape Ape with his head in the sky.
No.
He's a 40-foot purple gorilla with the mind of a child. The Oddball Couple, obviously based on the TV show, was a mischievous dog named Fleabag and his cat named Spiffy. Really, Fleabag, who live together under the same roof. Spiffy is an orderly and polite cat who is a stickler for cleanliness and organisation, and Fleabag is rude, obnoxious, lazy and untidy and very disorganised. So, yeah, there you go. Just like the TV show. Paddington Bear. Well, there's been films of this recently, so you get the idea of what Paddington Bear is. It's 1976 to 1980, 56 episodes, and again, it was stop motion. Paddington himself is a puppet in three dimensions. Everybody else is two-dimensional paper cutouts, including the backdrops as well, pretty much in black and white. Yeah, again, cute little bear. You instantly like him, and yeah.
Another one where there's so many other copycats. You've got Rupert, you've got Winnie the Pooh, you've got, you know, the bear format seems to constantly be going through. And I just don't know why one seems to pick itself out and last longer than the others.
Mm-hmm. Sean, did you ever get Dad's Army over in Canada?
If we did, I've never seen it.
Okay, there is an American version as well, but it was, again, that was very early 1950s, 1960s, sitcom based on the Home Guard in the UK, which would be all of the people who couldn't go to war in the World War II. It'd be all of the older people, and they were trained up as a sort of like a home guard, you know, in case there was an invasion. This was based on a lot of old people trying to be soldiers and et cetera, et cetera. One of the voices, one of the guys in there does the voice for this show, Sergeant Wilson, who is John Lee Majorier, voices Bod. Do we remember Bod at all, Dan?
Bod, yes. I think I remember this one. Yeah. Yep.
Here comes Bod.
It's first shown in 1975 with 13 episodes based on four original Bod books by Michael Cole and his wife Joanne. It is a cut-out animated cartoon series narrated by John Lee Majorier and Maggie Henderson, with music by Derek Griffiths and produced by David Yates. The character of Bod is a boy who lives in a town with Aunt Flo, PC Copper, Frank the Postman and Farmer Barleymo. Each of the characters has their own theme tune, produced by Griffiths, which is heard when they appear. There is also another set of characters who appear in each episode called Alberto Frog and his Amazing Animal Band. Now, that was my favourite part of it. Alberto Frog would feature short extracts from famous pieces of classical music as part of their story, and always ended up with Alberto Frog being rewarded for fixing something by him picking his flavour of milkshake. So, of course, me and my sister would watch it, and we'd have to guess which flavour of milkshake he'd be picking. Would it be strawberry, chocolate, or chocolate?
It's quite thirsty work conducting, Sir Alberto. I wouldn't say no to a milkshake. Any particular flavour? Said Mrs. Spencer.
It's going to be orange, thought Gnu.
It's going to be lemon, thought the ostriches.
It's going to be, vanilla, thought the hippos. Who do you think was right?
Lemon, said Alberto. The ostriches were right. Were you?
Still use that to this day. Another bizarre one, Chorlton and the Wheelies. Everyone remember that one? No? Okay. It takes place in Wheelie World, which is principally inhabited by a race of anthropomorphic creatures who locomote by means of wheels. They have three wheels, two large ones at the front, one at the back, resembling feet. The wheels are replaceable and suitable wheels grow on vegetation around Wheelie World. The Wheelies are in conflict with Fenella the Kettle Witch, an evil witch who speaks in a very strong Welsh accent and lives in Wheelie World, but separate from the Wheelies, in Sprout Hall. Blah, 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 blah. Bad things happen, and the Wheelies always win.
Sounds like a quaint British version of Jason and the Wheeled Warriors, Sean.
That's what I was thinking.
We then have Noah and Nelly in the Skylark. Obviously, Noah is obviously based on the biblical figure. It's all loosely based around Noah's Ark. However, the interpretation involves two-headed talking animals reminiscent of the Push-Me-Pull-You known to the Dr. Doolittle. Each animal has a cheerful and optimistic head at one end and an unhappy and pessimistic head at the other. Even the Skylark itself is a long ship with a figurehead at either end, one smiling and one frowning. Although there is only one animal of each type, they are referred to in the plural, Brian the lions, Rosie the elephants, etc. As with the earlier Rhubarb, the main narration is provided by British actor Richard Briers. However, co-narrator Peter Hawkins manages to find a different and appropriate voice for many animals. We mentioned him before, Captain Caveman and the Teen Angels. We all know that one. Captain Caveman! Voice was provided by Mel Blanc. Ludwig? Ludwig. This is another bizarre 5-minute cartoon. The character's name came from Ludwig van Beethoven, whose music is played in the background. The series consists of 25 5-minute episodes, each of which something would happen to the animals of the forest and Ludwig would come to the rescue. His body facets would open up and out would pop arms, legs, gadgets, even a helicopter rotor blade. Ludwig is an egg-shaped being. The Flumps, do you remember the Flumps at all, Dan?
I recognise the name, but not off the top of my head.
They look like small little pom-poms. You look at what you get on a bobble hat or something like that. Furry creatures called the Flumps. It was created and written by a couple of people. The theme tune was played by George Chisholm on the trombone. Grandpa Flump, who played the Flumpet. Father Flump was a keen gardener. Mother Flump, often seen doing the cooking in the kitchen, of course, because she's a woman. Posy, a girl Flump. Perkin, a boy Flump. And Poodle, the toddler Flump. Now we get into some good stuff. 1978. We're getting near the end of the 1970s here. And this is the last one that I remember from 1978. There's a reason for that. Battle of the Planets.
Planet. G-Force, Princess, Tiny, Hiop, Mark, Jason, and watching over them from Center Neptune, their computerized coordinator, Seven Zark Seven, watching, warning against surprise attacks by alien galaxies beyond space.
This is the first sort of time I really noticed Battle of the Planets was Japanese anime, and it was a totally different style of animation to any other I'd seen before. It's an American adaptation of the Japanese anime series called Science Ninja Team Catchaman, of the original series episodes 85 were used as Battle of the Planets adaptations. It's a cast of five young people as G-Force, consisting Mark, Jason, Princess, Keop, and Tiny. Always a Tiny that's a big guy. G-Force protects Earth from the planet's spectra and other attacks from beyond space. The most prominent field commander of the spectra forces was a villainous masked individual known as Zoltar. Zoltar would receive his orders directly from a being he would refer to as the Luminous One. The Luminous One would appear as a ghost-like, disembodied, floating head. Nobody really knows what it was. It was never explained. The main ship of the G-Force team was called the Phoenix, which would carry, transport, and deploy four smaller vehicles, each operated by one team member. The four vehicles included a futuristic race car with various hidden weapons driven by Jason, the Galacticycle, a futuristic motorcycle that Princess rode, the Space Bubble, an all-terrain tank-like vehicle capable of vertical takeoff and landing, as well as being submersible craft, that was driven by Keop. And lastly, a futuristic jet fighter Mark pilots, and that was stored in the top section of the Phoenix command island structure, which used its tail fin to make up the center tail fin of the Phoenix. The fifth crew member, Tiny, was assigned to pilot the Phoenix rather than one of its detachable craft. They all had martial arts skills, ninja-like weapons, and also a cerebronic power to dispatch hordes of enemy soldiers and overcome other obstacles. So, yes, I remember that one. Then we get to 1981, and I can't believe this was 1981. I thought it was a lot older than this, was Danger Mouse.
Yeah.
He was a secret agent, a parody of a British spy fiction, particularly Danger Man, and also James Bond. It originally ran from 1981 to 1982, 89 episodes. It was on ITV, so we didn't see too many of that. We were BBC people, don't you know?
He was dangerous. He was fantastic. Wherever there was danger, he was there. Danger Mouse.
Yeah.
Danger Mouse.
He's a bit of an unlucky person, though, isn't he?
Mm.
Postman Pat.
Postman Pat, Postman Pat, Postman Pat and his black and white cat. Early in the morning, just as day is dawning, he picks up all the post bags in his van.
British stop-motion animated television series first produced by Woodland Animations. The series follows the adventures of Pat Clifton, a postman close to Sean's heart here, who works for the Royal Mail Postal Service in the fictional village of Greendale. And he had a black and white cat as well.
Yeah,
take your cat to work day every day. And because it was in a small village, it was never in, you know, he wasn't trudging the usual places. He'd have to drive his van, drop the post off, and he'd also help various people doing various things. And then we're getting to a time where I was really running out of cartoons because I was getting a bit too old for this sort of thing. Here I am at the age of 16, Willow the Wisp. Originally produced in 1981 by the BBC, narrated by Kenneth Williams, became popular with children and adults as it bridged the gap between the end of the weekday children's programming and the early evening news. Kenneth Williams provided the voices for all of the characters. The principal narrator, Will-o'-the-Wisp, was a blue floating creature drawn as a caricature of Kenneth Williams, while the name refers to the ghostly light of Will-o'-the-Wisp from folklore. The other main characters were Arthur the Caterpillar as a gruff cockney, Mavis Cruet, a plump, clumsy fairy with erratic magic wand, and the principal antagonist, Evil Edna, a witch in the form of a walking television set who could zap people with her aerials. Other characters included Carwash, a snooty, respectable cat, who was based on Noel Coward with the catchphrase, "My eyes are not first class, you know." The Moog was a supposed dog who was not allowed to think for himself. Twit, a small bird. The Beast, a former prince turned into a hairy, shambling creature by Evil Edna. The Astronauts, a group of bugs who explore outer space by means of their toadstool rocket, bookworm, and gnomes, and a regiment of toy soldiers, which I don't really remember. 52 episodes of that.
Loved it. Really good.
And I was really getting too old for cartoons by this time, but Around the World with Willy Fogg popped up in 1984. Spanish-Japanese animated television adaptation of the 1873 novel Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne that was first broadcast in 1984. In the same vein as D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers, which I must have skipped past because I did watch that.
So
all for one and one for all. Musketeers was something or other. The characters are anthropomorphisms of various animals as the species depicted. There are much greater variety than that the series. The core trio are all felines being pursued by three canine foes. Willy Fogg, Phileas Fogg in the original book, is depicted as a lion. Rigadon, Passepartout, is a cat. And Romy, Aouda, is a panther. An English dub of the series was created, and while the series never achieved popularity in the United States, the English version found fame wherever it was broadcast. The series was initially screened in 1984 in the UK and has become repeated many times since. It's brilliant. It's a cracking little series.
Yeah.
And the last one, the very last one, there you go, you see. Because I've foreshadowed this in the previous one. D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers.
Yes.
One for all.
It's a children's animated television series that adapted the classic 1844 Alexandre Dumas story of D'Artagnan and Three Musketeers, produced by Spanish studio BRB, with the animation Japanese studio Nippon Animation. First broadcast in Japan in 1981 to 82, dubbed into English and shown in the BBC, on the BBC in 1985. Most of the characters are anthropomorphizations of dogs, hence the title of the cartoon. Although there are a few exceptions, most notably D'Artagnan's two sidekicks, Pip the Mouse and Planchet the Bear, amongst several others. Mm. And by that time, I was 19 going on 20, and I had no use for cartoons after that because they were all crap.
There you go.
No. Getting to the best decade coming up.
That's correct.
Well, we shall find out in maybe 4 weeks' time. 4 weeks' time, because we're going to be doing a different podcast next week. It'll be films of the 2000s for next week. And then the week after that, we'll go on to Sean's decade, I believe. When's that? What, did I say decade? Mine was a little bit more than a decade there, but 70s, 80s, 90s, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Excellent. Well, if you anybody out there listening remembers those shows, please get in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter, email us at cosmicpizzapodcast@gmail.com. Otherwise, that's the end of this episode. Hmm. Well, the pizza in the box is cold. The grease has gone rock hard. And we're all done. You just need to recycle the box, but you can't because it's greasy, so you have to just throw it in the normal bin. And that's the end of the episode. Thank you very much for listening.
Trompton Fire Station. Captain Flack here. What's that? Cuthbert? Ah, yes. It's his morning off. To Trompton Park. Yes, of course. Right away. Right away. Barney McGrew, Dibble, Grub.
We've been your deliverers today. Please leave a tip at the door by subscribing for future deliveries, rate and review our service, and we hope you come back for more helpings next time. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and TikTok by searching for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. If you'd like to send us an MP3 file, you can email us on cosmicpizzapodcast@hotmail.com. And we'll catch you on the next episode of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.